The journey to becoming an anti-racist, it's a messy one. So you'll mess up a lot. So anybody who's listening, just know that you'll fail. Do not use that as an opportunity to stay in your comfort zone. Anytime we're learning something new, whether it's anti-racism, whether it's learning how to apologize better, whether it's learning how to communicate better, anything that you do outside of your comfort zone will invite emotions that are very uncomfortable.
Hi guys, we're your hosts Jillian
and Kaylin,
and this is Teach Me How to Adult,
a podcast on all the things you never learned growing up, like how to buy a home, manage stress, crush your love life, land your dream job,
and how to love yourself more, because we could all be a little kinder to ourselves.
We're still figuring out how to get our shit together, so we're calling in the experts and the hustlers for some real talk and legit tips on how to live your best life.
Adulting isn't easy, but we got you.
Hi friends. Exactly 6 months to the day of the brutal murder of George Floyd, we had the privilege of talking to the absolutely brilliant, compassionate, and fabulous Carlin Purcell. She's a certified emotional intelligence and neurolife coach, and we chatted about the racial pandemic that we're facing, and specifically about the state of diversity and inclusion in the workplace, and how much more we can be doing to improve them.
Yeah, it was an amazing conversation, and these past 6 months have exposed the undeniable ugly truth that has always been present, especially for those who have been doing the work all along. Racism exists around the world. Its presence is systemic and entrenched in every facet of our society. And after a ton of research and learning, we've been focusing our efforts on making an impact in workplaces, in our own companies, and through educating in this podcast.
After all, the right to earning a living and work in a safe, inclusive workplace is a basic human right, and everyone should have the equal opportunity to pursue work that they care about and just bring their whole selves to work without fear.
Yeah, it's true. And if you've acknowledged that this problem exists, you're already in the right direction, and we have so many tools to help make an impact in this episode. Mm-hmm. If you don't believe there's a problem, however, allow us to educate you for a sec. First of all, Forbes reported that only 4 Fortune 500 companies have Black CEOs, and although Black people account for about 13.4% of the U.S. population, they only occupy 3% of senior leadership roles in large corporations.
And this is an old study, but also a very scary one. A 2003 study found that employers were more likely to consider white candidates with criminal records than they were to consider Black candidates with no such history. Like, these are American stats, but Canada is not doing any better, considering that Black Canadians are basically twice as likely as non-racialized Canadians to be in a low-income bracket. It's not good. And diversity shouldn't be a trend in the workplace or in life. It should just be a standard.
Yep.
And what's really sad is support for Black Lives Matter has dipped significantly since June. So we're really happy to be bringing this conversation back to the forefront. And here's a couple things that we could all be doing right now. I mean, we talk about this with Carlin in the episode, but just know that if you're embarking on this work or any sort of conversation on diversity and racism, you are going to mess up, more likely than not. And if you truly want to do the work and make this world a more equal place, you need to be able to identify those biases that you have within yourself and just be okay with getting uncomfortable and vulnerable.
Also, on the most basic level, I feel like we just need to acknowledge and respect people's diverse backgrounds in the workplace, whether that's their traditions and religions and style or their accents, right down to their literal names. I'm really disgraced by the fact that people from different communities and cultures come into workplaces that are predominantly white and are made to feel like they have to adopt new names or accept mispronunciation of their names in order to fit in, or because they wouldn't want to cause anyone discomfort. If we can pronounce Louis Vuitton and like some of the weird ass spelt words that we as white people pronounce daily, we can figure out how to pronounce someone's real name.
Yeah, agreed. And also understand that if you are a white individual, it is not up to the Black Indigenous people of color to help you become an anti-racist or an ally. Please do your research and do not put the burden of educating you on your Black employees and coworkers.
That's a huge one. Absolutely. And while when you're in the workplace, examine your company culture. And whether you're an intern or a CEO, you have the power to give feedback to HR and to your peers mm-hmm. about what your company culture is. Is it dated? Is it toxic? Is it exclusionary? How can you move the needle on that? I have left jobs because I disagree with the culture. Mm-hmm. That's because I'm in a place of privilege and I understand that. And most people are not in a place where they can just leave a job because they don't like the way that it's being run. Yeah. But if we all speak up, then those behaviors will have to shift because you will lose your talent.
Totally.
And if you're a hiring manager or you're in HR, take a hard look at your hiring practices. If you're hiring for fit or hiring for culture, you're just feeding into a natural default to hire people who mirror us. And I feel like I've brought that up with a lot of people in the past and they get a bit offended because they're like, I'm not a racist person. I'm not hiring for anyone except for, you know, the best person for the job. And I understand people are very quick to become defensive about their choices. Mm-hmm. But it is very natural for us to hire people who mirror us. It doesn't make you a bad person. We all gravitate towards people who we really relate to, or we're like, oh, they're so much like me. I'm just going to be able to work with them so seamlessly and easily. But there's a lot wrong with that, because that's not how you build a diverse team. That is not how you have inclusivity. You cannot just hire a bunch of people that are exactly like you. And that means you need to look at who's in the hiring room. You know, not, don't just have one person there who's calling the shots if it's just one white person. So make sure there's many people that get a say in hiring, and make sure that you're facing your own biases. I haven't had a ton of experience with hiring, but I can certainly identify an instance in which one time when I was sitting in on interviews, I was like, oh man, I'm not going to relate to this person at all. Like, they're like a hardcore video gamer and, like, you know, pretty nerdy. And I don't think I can relate to that. And I don't know if that's going to be a good fit. And I went down that road and I felt like quite ashamed of it after, because what they do in their free time has nothing to do with their ability to succeed on this team. And I fell into that bias of wanting someone who was similar to me. And so all we can do is acknowledge that those exist. Doesn't make you a bad person, but try to combat it.
And it's good that you acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Another key thing to do for companies when they're hiring is try to expand your network and hire from different schools and job fairs, because hiring from the same sources is just not going to give you diversity and inclusion in the company that you have. So creating like internship programs and hiring programs that can tap into those different universities and different communities is going to help broaden your talent pool. Offering mentorship or informational interviews for marginalized communities is also really key. And just being an advocate for those who are trying to break into your industry. And companies that are diverse legit perform better because they understand different perspectives, they tap into different markets, and can just speak to the actual society that we live in. Racially and ethnically diverse companies also perform 35% better than national medians, 87% better at decision making, and see 1.4 times increase in revenue.
Those are huge numbers. There's no argument against it.
No.
And if you feel like your workplace is engaging in toxic or discriminatory behavior, I know this is scary and hard, but try to find the courage to have a conversation with your manager and HR. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is tough. And yes, no one wants to, you know, like, put themselves in a situation that could harm their livelihood. But if you are a white person in a good job, in a good company, you have a lot less to lose in doing that. We have to use our privilege to speak up for those who would have a lot more to lose. There are people who cannot, they don't have the safety to come forward. So if you have the safety to say something, try to do it. It won't always yield the result that you're looking for, especially if you're the only one that's speaking up, and especially if there's issues within your HR department. But if enough people do speak up, it can't be ignored.
Yeah, there's power in numbers for sure. And leaders need to take ownership and be accountable for their actions. That's a big part of making change. They all play huge mm-hmm. roles in their companies and in their communities, and they should never, ever be offloading that responsibility onto their teams, and especially not their BIPOC staff.
Absolutely. It has to come from the top. Like, culture is truly built. It's modeled after the people at the top, and it trickles down. And of course, at the bottom, we can make a lot of impact and a lot of change, but we need to see that our leaders in every company are walking the walk.
Yeah. And if you listening are in a position of power, or even just feel comfortable enough to speak up, advocate for pay equity. Look at what a difference it made in Hollywood when white actresses started to refuse roles if their co-stars of color were not paid equally.
Even if you don't have a position of power where you work, or you don't feel comfortable making these big statements, you can literally make a huge difference starting tomorrow by doing small everyday things. For example, take stock of your go-to freelancers. So if you're only working with friends and people who look like you, can you diversify the talent and invest in growing budding talent from the BIPOC community? Literally devoting a portion of your freelance budget to marginalized communities can make such a huge difference for independent workers trying to break into these tough industries.
Yeah, and taking a look at the types of partnerships your company has too. Can you make a list of BIPOC-owned businesses and local businesses that you can add to your roster?
That's a great idea. And if your line of work references research studies or experts on the regular, are you using inclusive studies and experts? Don't be just getting quotes from white male doctors. Get quotes from all different types of people. Expand your roster of experts that you can pull in. And even examine your company's advertising and social feeds. Like, I don't want to look at a social feed if all I see is, if you're a fucking bikini company, bathing suit company, and it's just a bunch of skinny white women.
No.
Like, it is not appropriate that that is the only image that we are seeing in advertising and in social feeds. There needs to be a diverse range of ethnicities, genders, body types.
Representation. That is definitely key. Also, revisiting where your company's charitable donations are going to is really important. So make suggestions. Mm-hmm. If there are BIPOC causes that are being overlooked, make a list.
Yeah.
Send it in.
Honestly, beyond the history of slavery, I wish that we had been taught how racism exists in our structures now and how it impacts housing and how it's impacted the war on drugs and how the judicial system is innately racist. That's the biggest thing that I wish I had learned in school. There's so much to learn that we haven't learned, and this year has been a huge awakening for us, and the work certainly needs to continue. Honestly, it's tough to confront, but we all have bias within ourselves. And my favorite thing about our conversation with Carlin, which you are about to hear, is she approaches everything with such emotional intelligence and compassion. If you have biases or predispositions, mm-hmm. and you're working to understand those and to combat those, that doesn't mean that you're racist or that you're a shit person. It means that we need to take responsibility and educate ourselves and be self-aware and emotionally intelligent enough to understand our blind spots and to do better.
And we are not the experts. And although it is absolutely our job as white women to educate ourselves more on systemic racism, microaggressions, and how discrimination exists in the workplace, we called in certified emotional intelligence and neurolife coach Carlin Purcell because she has dedicated her career to increasing emotional intelligence in the workforce and helping corporations plan and execute diversity, equity, and inclusion strategies to support inclusive organizations. She knows her shit.
Every single thing she said to us was like mind-blowing. She's amazing. She is the CEO of KDPM Consulting Group and the founder of Sister Talk Group, which is a membership program dedicated to amplifying the voices of Black, Indigenous, women of color. You may have seen her on talk shows like CityLine, CBC, or in the pages of Forbes and Refinery29, where she promotes positive mindsets, productivity, and tools to live your best life. Honestly, she does it all.
Teach us how to build a more equitable workplace, Carlin. Just to kick things off, we'd love to hear more about KDPM Consulting that you founded and Amplify Her 2020. I mean, you're very multifaceted, so we would just love to know how those initiatives and your training as a certified emotional intelligence and neurolife coach has helped you transform corporate cultures and just foster a more inclusive environment with the people that you work with.
Whew, yes. And it's funny, I was just saying how much I love the name of your podcast, because everything that you just talked about, really, that's what got me to where I am today. Just to give you some background, I was born and raised in the Caribbean in a small village called Bus Labowi in an island called St. Lucia. When you grow up in the islands in the Caribbean, you either work for the government or, you know, a bank, right? These are like the good jobs. So one of the things that you learn growing up is that get a good job so that you can continue contributing towards, you know, your family and your legacy. So when I left the Caribbean and I moved here, it was quite a culture shock. Number one, I didn't realize that there was a culture around immigrants, and I felt that difference in terms of how people treated me, but also just trying to quote unquote fit in the culture at the bank that I was still working with. And that also brought along its own set of challenges. And for a while, I really felt like a fish out of water. I didn't really know where to go, who I can talk to, but as I encountered more individuals, especially those with diverse backgrounds, other immigrants such as myself, we realized we all had this commonality in the sense of really trying to figure out how do we bring our full selves to work without feeling like an outsider. That's what led me to understanding what are emotions and what emotional intelligence and wait, my emotions have intelligence? Whoa, mind blown. Like totally mind blown. And that led me down a rabbit hole. So I turned to people like Tony Robbins and Brené Brown and, you know, Napoleon Hill, and they became my teachers. They taught me how to, like, for example, Napoleon Hill, I call him my virtual mentor. He talks a lot about, you know, whatever the mind can conceive, it can achieve. So I was like, interesting. Tell me more. Which led me down the road of neuroscience, emotional intelligence. So I got certified in both. I decided to bet 100% on myself. And I decided to start KDPM Group to help not just individuals, but mostly organizations to transform the culture, but do it by rehumanizing us, not just us as individuals, but also ensuring that we center the human experience as part of the process.
So we wanted to start off by talking about an article that you were quoted in Refinery 29, written by Kathleen Newman Brimming on listening and learning sessions.
Oh my God, she's so awesome.
I'm such a fan. I'm such a fan of Refinery and of Kathleen's work. It was such an impactful article. It really affected us. And it was all about these listening and learning sessions that companies are diving into right now. And when done wrong, I think we now are starting to realize that these sessions, first of all, they can be very lazy. They can be a bit of a cop-out, devoid of action, and they can stoke resentment. And, you know, worst of all, they could create an unsafe, dehumanizing environment for people of color who are participating. So we would love any advice that you have on how companies can run ongoing sessions that truly promote empathy and emotional intelligence and accountability and an actual understanding of diversity and bias and racism.
Ooh, yeah, it's and I say that with, you know, the awareness that A, there is a right way to do it and there's a wrong way to do it. Sending a company-wide email or memo or at your town hall to rehash the experiences of Black individuals and other racialized and historically and systemically marginalized equity deserving groups, it's very irresponsible. And in my opinion, it's a direct violation of an individual's human right. But organizations have been doing it for years, and it has been allowed because of the lack of accountability that we have placed on leaders who hold the responsibility to ensure that they're extending that, to your point, empathy to all individuals. But again, if you understand the history of racism, if you understand the history of how anti-Blackness forms itself within the various, you know, parts of our society, then you will know that doing that, you need to ensure that you're centering the experiences of Black individuals or racialized individuals. And what does that look like? This looks like not sending a company-wide memo and asking everybody to come to a town hall and asking your Black employees to rehash the experiences in front of people who might have, in some way, shape, or form, whether it's conscious or not, have harmed those individuals over and over again because of oppressive systems and structures and also practices as well in terms of leadership competencies and behaviors. So the right way to do it is that it needs to be grounded. I always say, A, it needs to be grounded in in psychological safety, meaning that you center the experiences of Black individuals. You actually center the lives and the experience of those who are the most impacted. And if you're talking about, you know, if George Floyd is a catalyst for you to have that discussion of individuals, then just know that you're not talking about George Floyd. You're talking about my brother, my uncle, my family, like people who look like me, but also you're talking about the fact that my experiences have not been recognized within this workplace. Like I left the bank 20 years in the bank. I never really had a forum to talk about the microaggressions. I didn't have agency or permission or confidence to talk about microaggressions in the workplace. A lot of my work talking about it publicly happened after I left the bank because I just did not feel safe because we did not have psychological safety, especially when you look at it through the lens of the Black experience. So the right way to do it is to ground it in that knowledge and ensure that it is tied to a larger strategy that will actually bring about transformational change, not just on the cultural level, but also look at it throughout, because racism is a system. It's not a person. It's in our institutions, in our practices, in our policies, and our way of doing and being. But it's also in structural as well, right? So when companies look at, for example, the corporate social responsibility mandates, which I love, you know, Angela Davis's reframe, and she's like, you're talking about corporate social responsibility, you're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. What you're talking about is social justice. What you're talking mm-hmm. about is racial justice, right? How can I make sure that as an organization that I am actively giving back in a way that is meaningful to those communities, right? Because if not, then you're back to this white savior complex, where now you're saving us when we don't need saving. All we're saying is that we want the same human right that has been extended to historically to white groups and white individuals who have created not just policies, but they literally created a whole culture around the enslavement of Black folks, where we use the expertise and the experiences to bolster and create our wealth and to make us look cool in some cases, because you've heard about, you know, appropriation as well, right? How Black culture mm-hmm. is cool, but for most times, we are not rewarded or recognized for it,
right.
But you're not recognizing them for it. So it needs to be a part of a larger strategy in terms of what are you doing to ensure that you're dismantling those systems, because systems don't dismantle themselves, people do. So are you equipping the people who are now have the decision-making power and the policy-making power to change those systems? And most importantly, if you're asking for an audience, if you're Black, Indigenous, whatever marginalized group it is, group of employees, what is your promise to them to ensure that by them giving you their trust and talking about our lived experience, which, by the way, is not the first time we're talking about it, what are you doing to ensure that you're taking that gift and you're using it in a way to ensure that you do not repeat the cycle again? So for me, it needs to be grounded in something bigger than just, let's just have a conversation, because we've been having conversation for years and we're tired. Yeah.
And I think that accountability piece that you just mentioned is where what I'm seeing a lot of companies are falling flat in, and they do the town halls and these sort of one-offs and check the box, but what's next? And how do you, exactly. how do you get your employees to keep you accountable and keep themselves accountable for keeping the conversation going and just changing the corporate culture that needs to be changed? So
yes, and culture is again, it's not something we can change overnight, right? So it needs to be, I understand that change will take time, right? When you talk to effectively change your culture, you're looking at least 2 to 3 years, because there's the intellectualization of racism, which, you know, my dear friend, she's the host of CEO of Inner Field Trips, Lisa, and she says that, you know, the intellectualization of racism have allowed individuals to literally step aside from the horror of the history of anti-Black racism. And because of that, individuals feel comfortable not taking the necessary action, because in order for you to take action, it means that you have to give something away, whether that's power, whether that's some sort of privilege, in different ways and in different forms.
You mentioned microaggressions. So for those who have not been doing any listening or learning in the past 6 months, could you just walk us through what those look like and sound like commonly, and sort of explain the difference between intent and impact when it comes to our language that we use in the workplace?
It was a term actually coined by Daryl Sue Wang, and he framed it as, you know, daily racial insults and slurs that are hurled in terms of words, actions, and behaviors at racialized groups and individuals. It's micro because he used that framing to talk about it in terms of the interpersonal aspect, in terms of that one-on-one. But what we know is that that micro actually, it's macro aggression, because it's kind of like the death of a thousand cuts, where you've been getting that for years. And for a lot of us, especially myself, like I said before, while I was at the bank, I didn't have agency. I didn't have confidence. So I didn't really talk about it. And that can sound like, again, good intention. You heard me speak. It was amazing. And you're like, oh my God, Carlin, you're so articulate. You're so eloquent. Like, you sound amazing. And well-intentioned. And I probably did. And I probably said something that really resonated with you, which is amazing. But again, if you understand historically how stereotypes have been used to dehumanize Black individuals and our expertise and how we're positioned in the world, then you would understand that this is actually a racial microaggression. Right? So you're actually causing more harm. So the impact on me is that now, instead of me feeling great, okay, you know, Jillian gave me such a great call. Now I'm just like, ugh, here it goes again with the eloquent and the, you know, right. she's so articulate for a Black girl. And when you understand the history of it, then you can understand why for me that's a macroaggression, because that's not the first time I've heard it. So how can folks now deal with that? And again, the journey to becoming an anti-racist, it's a messy one. So you'll mess up a lot. So anybody who's listening, just know that you'll fail. Do not use that as an opportunity to stay in your comfort zone, right? Anytime we're learning something new, whether it's anti-racism, whether it's learning how to apologize better, whether it's learning how to communicate better, anything that you do outside of your comfort zone will invite or solicit emotions that are very uncomfortable, like whether it's helplessness or shame or fear. Also why I dived into the intelligence of emotions, because I wanted to know, how do I use that and not let that keep me stuck in my past or in my conditioned self or in my conditioned patterns? So you will mess up. Use this to build on your ability to have courageous conversations. So notice the emotion, acknowledge it, and be like, oh crap, I did say it again, didn't I? Let me check in. Feel the shame, feel the fear. It's normal, it's human to have it. And now go back and say, oh, Carlin, I said da da da. And maybe also that time, you know, when you said, I might be okay with it because I'm a different headspace. That's not the fifth or 10th or 15th one that was blatantly shared in my face, right? Because that's not the only ones we go through. But check in. And how do you avoid that for Black individuals and other racialized groups? Be specific about the feedback you're giving them. Very simple way, right? Say, Carlin, when you talked about emotional intelligence and that piece you said about emotions being data, whew, you blew my mind. Here's why. Right. Yes, you might not know that, but that is the whole part, to your point, Kaylin, around people learning and listening. Because a huge part of racism is that historically, a lot of that knowledge and understanding is not in our history books. But think twice before you ask a Black person or another racialized person the burden of educating you. We have Google now. Yes, I grew up without a computer or phone and all of those things, but it's 2020. I think most individuals now have internet, we have access. So you can Google and you'll find tons of free content on educating yourself around anti-racism.
And I'm really glad that you pointed out that people will fuck up and say the wrong thing sometimes. Yes. And it's okay, because as you said before, to dismantle racism, it also involves giving something away, whether that's privilege or power, but it can also be like comfort, giving away a bit of comfort. And exactly. I think we just all have to be okay with being uncomfortable and knowing that is a very small price to pay. It's better to just be brave and do as Brené Brown would want us to do, and to kind of not let shame trap you, because then we'll never learn and grow.
Exactly. And then we end up making this world worse than we found it. Like, what's our legacy? Right. I often invite my, you know, my white friends and colleagues and people doing this work. I tell them, what kind of legacy would you want to leave behind? Let's say your great, 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 great grandfather owned slaves. Okay. Again, you weren't there, right? But you're here now. Part of your responsibility as being a good ancestor is to now right the wrong. Not fully. You can't do that fully. But what can you do today? Look at context. Look at the situation, right? What can you do today with the knowledge that you have, knowing what you know? What can you do today to right that wrong? And even when you look at within the Black experience as well, there are a lot of people who are mixed, because a lot of our great, great, great grandparents were also products of rape, because the slave owners raped the Black women and also used the men as mules to create more individuals to work on the plantations. And again, keeping in mind that we were enslaved, we were dehumanized, didn't get paid. And our expertise were huge. So when you look at even history in the sense of a lot of those, you know, some white folks who invented certain things, again, it came from that slave owner for some of them. So there's a history of the erasure of our experience and our expertise, and also the fact that we did not get paid. And even when slavery was abolished, there were policies that prevented us from setting up our homes in different areas. Hence the reason why you have a lot of marginalized groups and communities in certain areas, which has now been stigmatized. But again, it's not like we wanted to go there. But again, history has forced us there. So the education piece will be ongoing until we all exit this earth. And I think if you are here in 2020 and you were able to bear witness and you can use your privilege, your voice, your comfort, your systemic privilege, especially for white folks who have that systemic privilege, if you're not using it for good, then what side of history are you really choosing? because you're choosing the side of the oppressor. And if you're choosing the side of the oppressor, then it means that you're also responsible for ensuring that so many individuals continue to be at the mercy or still experiencing systemic racism in so many different ways.
Wow. Yeah. And I like what you said earlier too about learning how to apologize appropriately. I think that's another issue that is happening right now. When someone is called in, it starts off with them being defensive, and that's not the point. It's unlearning. It's acknowledging, oh, I'm sorry. And then wipe that from your vocabulary and tell your friends and tell your family and make sure that you're taking that learning and sharing it with others, to your point of sort of what side of history do you want to be on, and using that privilege position to be called in for better.
And I love that you said that, because I think it's a huge part of the work people don't talk about enough, that creating a culture of accountability within white groups and communities and other non-Black, again, I'm speaking through the lens of anti-Black racism, so hence the reason why I'm using this language. Creating a culture of accountability the onus needs to be on these individuals doing the work. So I'm very happy that you mentioned that, because that's very crucial. It's a key point people need to remember. Share your stumbles with others, right? Because again, you will stumble, you will fall, you will fail, you will say the wrong thing. Accept it. Yeah. And also, if you are still defending, it means that you haven't learned about the intelligence of your emotions, because you're using that emotional data to stay stuck where you are. So again, what would happen if you increased your emotional intelligence around your emotional data? If you understood that, wait, defensiveness is showing up, but what is really behind this? Oh, fear. Fear of what? Fear that I might be labeled as racist. Oh, crap. What does that really mean, though? Am I racist? No. Did I say something racist in the past? Probably. But did you know better? No. Did you know what you know now? No. And that's why I'm taking, you know, a positive psychology, an emotional intelligent lens in the work that we do, especially with the organizations we work with, because we have to meet people where they are. Change is a very messy journey, and you cannot force people to change. And using vulnerability as strength, I think, isn't something a lot of people can start doing, especially after this year. We need to incorporate that more into our day-to-day.
Absolutely.
I could not agree more. Could you walk us through how people can be better allies through the LEAP, L-E-A-P strategy that I believe that you coined?
Yeah. So when the outburst first happened, I was thinking of how can I help people shift from where they are, again, from our conditioned self. In the past, you didn't know all of this in terms of anti-Black racism and so forth. But now that you know a little bit more, how can we get you to LEAP so you're not stuck into your past and your conditioned self? And LEAP L stands for listen and learn, so that you can unlearn the unconscious acts of overt and covert racism that might have been a part of your behavior, your words, and your actions. E stands for examine and explore not just your own history, but also the emotions that are tied to that history. A is for ask and then act. Asking meaning before you actually go and ask, whether it's for help or support or engaging with the Black community in terms of what you can do, make sure that you're asking based on an informed decision. So for example, have you listened? Have you learned? Have you explored your own history? Because you have the four dimensions of racism. It's intrapersonal, meaning that it's internalized, like the oppressor, in terms of that persona, in terms of the things that you did because you didn't know, right, how you consciously contributed towards upholding systemic barriers, whether it's in the workplace or in the society and so forth. But also, what have you done with that data and that information? Because if we don't take personal responsibility for the role that we unconsciously played, whether you're active in it or not, then when it comes to taking bold action to create change, then we will see a lull or lower rate of action being done. So the first two gives you permission. It's like a permission slip for you to start taking action, because that action is informed and that action will cause less harm. Again, not to say you won't cause harm, you might, but also you'll cause less harm because you're coming from an informed place. And that action needs to be activity that causes transformation, right? It cannot be posting a square on Instagram. What did that actually shift? What did that change? That doesn't change anything. Are you using your voice? Like with the example I use for an Interior Black History Society, and I often remind allies, first of all, ally is not a title you give yourself. It's a title that the community you're supporting is going to give you, right? So I can say you're an active ally because I've seen your participation, I've seen your consistency, and I can lean on you as an ally. But allyship is a journey. and it's not a designation or destination. So that journey includes that taking action, but taking action on behalf of the community by reading the reports and following the organizations that are led by Black folks, that are informed by the experiences of Black folks. Because there have some different, I've seen different individuals start in certain things, you know, I want to support the community, but it's led by white people. And I'm like, what are you doing? Right? Equity is building with. If you have a great idea, I'm not saying you cannot take action on it, but if you have a great idea and you want to be a great ally, build with. Who is a Black person I can co-create with? I can build with. And I heard this from another speaker where they said, and I've been using it a lot, white supremacy is power over. Equity is building power with, right? So leveraging that will lead you now to P, and P stands for prioritizing and practicing daily acts of equitable behavior. So what does that look like every day, right? If what are some of your daily activities? I often remind people to be an effective ally, start by disrupting your lifestyle, right? So for me, if I look at this through the lens of my own, you know, allyship journey, one of the, and I call it a role I'm applying for, right? In terms of allyship, one of the roles I'm applying for is allyship within the Indigenous community and how I'm preparing for that role. So I buy my lipsticks from Cheekbone Beauty, Gemma Face. I'm actually wearing Gemma Face, is also a Black owned brand as well. So I prioritize and I practice by infusing and making it a part of my day-to-day, purchasing from those individuals, following them online, amplifying the voices of certain groups. Look for certain groups that you follow that you know that you want to ensure that you're amplifying their work, and share it on your LinkedIn, on your social media. Like when you do that, and you ensure that you're learning from the right source, then it becomes easier for you to continue practicing and amplifying the voices of those that needs to be heard.
I love that. That's you're helpful. Putting your money where your mouth is, basically.
Yes, yeah. Your money, your voice, your
voice,
words.
Everything.
Everything, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Very important. So I want to chat about hiring, because hiring is probably one of the most crucial components to building a diverse and inclusive workplace and team. And we all know we need way more representation of Black, Indigenous, people of color on our teams, and especially our leadership teams too. But we often hear outdated practices like hiring for fit, and I'm using air quotes. So how does that prevent diversity, and how do we dismantle what a good fit even means in corporations, if that's a hiring manager's natural default?
Well, hiring for fit in itself is oppressive, right? This is an oppressive practice, because when you look at it by definition, you're saying that. And it's so exclusionary as well, because I'm pretty sure both of you have heard the term within the workplace. It's like, bring your full self to work, be authentic. Yeah. And then they hire for fit. And it's like, so which one do you want, right?
Yeah.
And hiring for representation without a psychological safety strategy, especially for equity deserving groups, is very irresponsible. Because what you end up doing is that the pressure of being the only, doesn't matter what level you are in the organization, you feel it, right?
Yeah.
Culture is informed, or culture, we create culture based on the active participation of those individuals who are in the workplace. If your majority group are white individuals, especially if it's individuals in the decision-making, whether it's communications, HR, et cetera, the standards of excellence, of what is appropriate, of what is acceptable, is defined by those individuals, consciously and unconsciously, right? Because if you think of it through the lens of, okay, I want to hire for representation, and your individuals from the department that you're bringing this individual into, they're all white, or maybe very, very little diversity in terms of representation and in terms of intersectionality, then the lens that you're using to assess that individual is coming from your own unconscious and conscious bias. Right? Because bias, again, is a shortcut, is a judgment. The brain uses that so that you can make decision, because we process so many different decisions and words and emotions in a day. So it creates that bias. So bias can be good. Bias is good. It's a function of our brain. It's how we operate and how we're able to survive and thrive in life. And it requires the awareness of individuals to ensure that you're not allowing not just your personal biases, but also systemic biases. And when you look at the function of HR, human resources, they need to ensure that they're centering the experiences of all humans. But historically, what we've heard, especially from Black individuals, we don't trust HR. I didn't feel comfortable going to HR. I don't feel comfortable going to my employee assistant group either, getting wellness tips and ideas. Why? Because A, I don't see myself represented. And it's you, and when you're talking about a microaggression or anything to do with your own personal safety in the workplace, it's very hard to try to explain it to someone, especially historically when your experiences have always been denied every time you say it. Are you sure that happened? Really? You sure it happened this way? Maybe not, right? So there isn't that empathy that's extended to racialized individuals and groups. So what I would encourage HR individuals to do, if when you're looking at your HR team right now, very simple, start there. Do they all look like you? Then you need to outsource and get some more equity-based strategies to help you to ensure that you're not causing more harm within the workplace. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that's something that you can fix overnight, but that can be the first. The second step is when you're setting up those interviews, who are the individuals interviewing those folks? Who are the individuals who are now assessing that person based on their own bias? Or do you have someone in terms of relatability where that individual can actually see themselves represented? Because your responsibility is also to ensure that you're showing this individual that we're willing to ensure that you can actually show up as your full self at work. So it's multi-layered and multifaceted. And HR leaders need to have the courage. And also, we need to raise the standard for leadership behaviors in the workplace. Because I think historically, we have allowed leadership, inclusive leadership behaviors to cruise control around creating safety for one group, which is whiteness mm-hmm. is the majority culture in most organizations. And that has been prioritized for years, which really is a definition of white supremacy, right? Centering whiteness, mm-hmm. centering white experiences. Everything is coming from the white lens of white gaze, right? You start there, start unraveling there. And again, keep on hearing and listening to your employees. Again, listening to them with responsibility and understanding that you're listening to them to create change. And you're ensuring that there is accountability, there's transparency, and that you're building with them so that they are aware that what you're building will also really work for them as well.
Absolutely. And I feel like it's so important that everyone is able to acknowledge that even if you have the best intentions in the world, everyone does contain some bias. A lot of time, it's their natural default to hire someone who is looks similar like to them. Yeah. Because you're like, oh, well, we hit it off really well. We just had a great connection. Oh, I can't put my finger on it, but they just, they seem like a great fit. And, and this is the kind of person I know I'd have a great rapport with. And they don't even really acknowledge or understand that you're just trying to hire yourself and people that are just like you.
Yes.
And I mean, the facts are there that if you don't want to take a stand just morally to do the right thing, your company will succeed and do better if it is diverse. Like the numbers are there. The bottom line has proven that it is of benefit to every company to be ensuring that it's representative and that everyone has a place at the table.
Absolutely. And also the other thing I would say too is don't hire one at a time, hire in threes. So if you're looking for a diverse candidate, hire in threes if you can, or at least stagger it, or find ways to ensure that that individual feel like they're seen, heard, valued, and respected based on who they are, so that they can really bring all their full selves to work, right? And another thing that I'll share, I just saw a recent study that was shared recently. They did a survey on which countries are the most racist in terms of when it comes to hiring. And Canada is right on there. I know. I like us knowing our reality. It is what it is, right? So at least we know. I always say the truth is a great place to start. But again, whose truth are you centering? Because we have been saying this for decades, changing whitening resumes and changing names on resumes. And a lot of racialized individuals and other, you know, groups who historically have been marginalized have had to change their names, which again, the names are rooted in their spirituality and the culture and the things that gives them strength and allows them to bring their full selves to work. But they've had to adapt and change. Why? Because society said, hey, we're prioritizing whiteness and we want to say names like Ben or John or Joe because it's easier for us, right? So it's so layered, right? But also I think it gives us a great opportunity for Canada to do the right thing. For a country that, you know, is so diverse, like we're even more diverse than the U.S., and other places, right? You can see the incompetence in a lot of our leaders. And I'm not saying people cannot make mistakes because, like I said, learning is a messy journey, but it brings into question who are the people you have around you. So going back to confirmation bias, right? Would the Prime Minister say what he said, even his response to the blackface was more damaging. Mm-hmm. And you can tell he did not have a person of color or black person mm-hmm. on his communication staff, his period.
Team, yeah.
You're on his mm-hmm. team. Yeah, you can tell. Mm-hmm. Because based on what was said, right? And how it was said. So it gives us an opportunity. I think 2020 has given us an opportunity for us to raise the bar on the standards of leadership, on how we hold leaders, because I'm pretty sure both of you have also seen our young ones are pretty smart. They're brilliant, oh, yeah. right? The generation that's coming, they're brilliant and they're not settling for the status quo. Yeah. And if it means that you and I, both of us, all three of us have to sit with our discomfort and work harder at understanding the intelligence of our emotions and how our brain works so that we can move through to action, that's a really small price to pay.
On the hiring point as well, I heard Avery Francis talking about some of the key differences between like diversity and tokenism in the workplace when you are hiring. And how can we ensure companies are pursuing diversity in their practices and not just tokenism?
It's just so fascinating to see how educating people and telling them that saying representation matters without the strategy to show that it does matter is actually a racial microaggression, to get them to understand that and understand that we want to be seen for our expertise. I don't want you to hire me because I happen to be a black girl who's a woman who's doing this work, but because I am great at what I do, and I am. I just happen to be black and fabulous, but that's not the point, right? The point is, I have studied this. Yes, it's a part of my experience, but I also have the academia. So for a lot of us, we want to be known for our expertise. So it goes back to the how do you get away from that tokenism? Like I said, hiring, it was actually Dean Dory at the OCAD University. She said that. She said high in threes. And if you're high in threes, you increase your psychological safety. You increase the success rate for employees to thrive. So that was from her. And the other thing that I would say is to ensure that your onboarding process celebrates the expertise of that person and not the fact that they're a diversity hire, which again, to me, it's so dehumanizing. There was this individual who said in a session that I was in, and he said, I want to stand out for the right reasons. And I think that is the key thing for me, standing out for the right reason, because we do have the expertise. So if organizations and individuals and people leaders can amplify that, I think that is a step in the right direction, because it also really helps by doing this too. You also help to de-bias from your preferred modes of biases, which is usually confirmation bias or affinity bias, where, we went to school together. Oh my God, you must be amazing because my school is amazing. And associating with you is going to, you know what I mean? Or confirmation bias based on, your visible ethnic points, right? The brain is wired for connection, and we're also wired for safety and comfort. So again, defaulting to those things does not mean you're a racist person or you're a bad person. It just means that you need to be aware. So self-awareness in the leader is extremely important. You need to be aware when you might be erring on the side of tokenism, whether it's that's in your words, language, beyond the hiring, and use that data to switch, to be more inclusive, to teach your brain that, hey, I can de-bias on the spot, but also I can use presence and mindfulness as a tool to be more inclusive in my day-to-day actions.
Mm-hmm. That is like a hiring manager's like checklist right there for how they should do it right.
Yes, that's definitely part of it. And also we need to evolve diversity, equity, and inclusion. By that, I mean, in the past, I feel like it has been a band-aid where a lot of the decision-making folks who also happen to be white folks hire their friends to come and do stuff more like a band-aid. It's not equity-based. Right. It's not looking at it through the lens of intersectionality, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we need the whole model itself needs to evolve. We need to be looking at it through the lens of Peter Trevor Wilson, who is the author of The Human Equity Advantage. His model, what I really love about his model around human equity is that, and equity is about, it's understanding that we all didn't start off the same place. Every individual is starting off. When we look at it through the lens of racialized groups or race, then we know based on race, East Asians, South Asians, and indigenous folks, black people, self-identifying people of color, our race have defined our experiences in many different ways on the institutional, structural, interpersonal, and also personal level as well. So it means that if there was an organization who has been doing this really well, then we would have an organization where I can actually see true representation at all levels. Like, corporate spaces, like Fortune 500 companies, the senior leadership teams would not look like how it looked like back in the day when we had segregated schools here in Canada or in the US, right? Yeah. I often say that corporate is the grown-up school, the grown-up version of segregation of schools.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right? Think about it. Ruby Dee, she's, again, she's what, her 60s? I don't know who that version of that child is here from the Black lens here. But we know when we look at the Indian schools for the Indigenous, this is our history here in Canada. Yeah. Where children were dehumanized, their names were ripped away from them, and the culture was taken away from them, the language was taken away from them. When you strip all of those things that make us human, where at the core of who we are as human beings, we all want to feel seen, heard, valued, and respected for who we are, but you took all of that away from me, and now you're telling me that I should go on and still thrive in society while you continue to historically dehumanize me. Like but then Canada's like, yeah, human rights, and we love people, and we love our Indigenous, and we talk about the land, or we talk about, you know, yes, Black Lives Matter, but our actions are not matching up to our words. So we really need to bridge that gap, and I'm really hoping to see more people continue bridging that gap, not just this year, but over the next decade as well.
And I think it's important that you acknowledge Canada specifically, because I think we have this rose-colored glasses view of our multicultural country, and we think that we're immune to racism. It's just, it happens in the South. It happens in the US. It's not happening here. But we have a deep-rooted history of it, and it's ongoing. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to wake up.
Absolutely. And I'm happy you're teaching people how to adult to do that, because we need every single person on the ground, because we need to build that culture of accountability in the Canadian society as well. As we continue doing work, you know, in the workplaces, at our homes, we also need to ensure that the Canadian culture reflects the multiculturalism and the diversity of people, thoughts, ethnicities, gender, race, all the things here as well.
And do you have any recommendations for how businesses or public figures on social media right now should be reacting to racial injustice or to criticism if they're called in? I think a lot of people are struggling with that.
What I would say is that before you go in, if someone calls you in, before you go into your shame spiral or your defensiveness, sit with the emotions and increase your appetite for discomfort. I think that gives individuals an opportunity to take that emotional data and to look at what is my best next step. Maybe you're feeling embarrassed, you're feeling the shame. Again, normal human experiences. Now, what am I doing with this? So I often use, you know, with our clients, I call it the 3 C's coach-like approach towards becoming an anti-racist. And the first C starts for curiosity. When we use curiosity as a lens, what we end up doing is that we end up literally disrupting our systemic, our personal biases, because it gives us an opportunity to move away from our automatic response, which is if someone says something and you go into a shame spiral or fear spiral, you want to defend, right? The brain will immediately go into protective mode, fight, flight, or freeze. So if we increase our appetite for discomfort, then that gives us more opportunities for us to choose a more equitably based behavior. So that's the first thing. And the second thing I would say is to build a small, your little group of your allyship group, a little board of directors of allies. So instead of going into your shame spiral or doing nothing, reach out to your friend, reach out to Jill, reach out to Kayla, whoever you have on your list. Reach out to them and share with them, hey, I'm struggling with this. I don't think I handle it well. What are your thoughts? So the second C, this is where compassion comes in. And compassion means that you're extending those lens of compassion to yourself. What am I feeling right now? Yes, I'm feeling this. Again, you may be feeling shame or you may be feeling fear. You are not your emotions. Emotions are data. It's information to let you know where you stand on a particular point. And the lack of knowledge around that point is what is inciting that fear, because the brain does not like ambiguity and it does not like change, right? So that's the second step in terms of compassion. Compassion gives us an opportunity to convert that into empathy. And empathy is where we can now take that action, right? How do we take all that feelings of helplessness and our desire to help and put it into action? This is where courage comes in. And courage is a muscle. When we operate from the heart, it means that we're seen. I'm seeing you as a human because I also have acknowledged my humanness, my humanity. So courage will now give us an opportunity for us to say, what is the best next step? Am I afraid? Absolutely. Again, feel the fear and do it anyways. So that is, I would say, start there with the three C's and leverage that as part of a way for you to keep moving forward.
Wow, that's so helpful. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Adulting is hard. So I think it's important for us to keep talking to each other, keep sharing our journey, keep making vulnerability a strength, prioritizing it as a strength, and use that. And I often remember what Brené Brown said, where she said, and actually 7 years ago when we first appeared on Oprah's Life Class and we got a chance to talk to her, the number one question I asked her was, because that was my biggest struggle at the time, I'm like, can I bring vulnerability into the workplace? And if so, how? And then she was like, again, sharing the stories, talk about it. And she said, if we remove vulnerability on the table as a valued, you know, skill or emotion, then you also have to take off innovation, creativity, engagement off the table as well. So prioritizing vulnerability is extremely important. And remember that, yes, we are all on this journey together, but we're not all in the same boat. So even for you on your allyship journey with each other as white allies, you might see someone doing something that might be more harmful. Extend that compassion to them as well and call them in so that, again, you can continue building that culture of accountability so everyone can move forward towards the action and change that we seek.
I love that. That's so great. Courage over comfort. 100%.
Always.
Yeah. And not attacking each other too. I love that you said that as well. Rather than policing everyone, trying to more so come at these things with, we're all learning and growing. And if we can approach things with compassion to help each other grow, then we'll be in a better place and there'll be less defensiveness. And I think we'll net out better.
Exactly.
It has helped so many people, and anyone who has ever just taken a journey through your social feeds will see your positivity and all of the motivation and inspiration you offer. It's really lovely.
Thank you. Thank you. I try to share, you know, the messy middle as well. And I try to keep it real as much as possible. So I really try to remind people that life is messy, and the messy middle, sometimes it can get really hard, right? And this is why for me, understanding the power of my emotions, the fact that I have agency and autonomy over my mind and my mindset, that I can actually manifest the life that I want, shut the front door. Teach me, show me.
And our last question that we love to ask all of our guests is, what is one thing that you wish you had been taught in school?
Oh, emotional intelligence, honestly. anything around how the brain works and emotional and EQ, EQ should be taught in school. The power of self-awareness. I often say self-awareness is my superpower because it gives me insight on who I am and who I am becoming. So if we taught EQ at school, then a lot of the anxiety and fear and shame that people are allowing to lead their lives, we'll be able to use that information better. And we'll also be able to bridge that empathy gap much faster as well, which can lead to more impactful change in our society.
I love that. I can think of a lot of people that could have used that lesson in school for sure.
Right? I mean, forget anti-racism, forget all of this. We all know people who could have used that lesson, right?
Yeah. So tell everybody where they can find you.
How to adult. Oh my goodness. So everyone can find me. I mean, I haven't been as active because this year has just been, I'm teaching, I'm experiencing. There are just so many different hats that I'm wearing. If people are looking for ways to build on the EQ, also my success planner, which is one of the tools that I designed actually years ago, making time for what matters the most. A lot of the things I talk about in terms of self-reflection and creating, prioritizing, you know, daily acts of inclusion. There's a habit tracker as well. Like if your default mode, understanding your default mode around racism, you can track that, right? If it's defensiveness, start with self-awareness. How often do I react defense? And what's my sense of behavior? What's my stance? It's on Shopify, Success Planner. That's where we have it. If you go on my Instagram, you'll also go on my bio. You'll find a link for it. And also follow me on Twitter. LinkedIn is where we share a lot of our articles for corporate leaders. And next year, we're bringing out some more tools to help support individuals on their journey. So stay tuned for that as well.
Thank you so much for this amazing conversation and taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
We hope this episode inspires you to take action in your workplace and further your journey to becoming an ally. We'll leave you with a quote from Carlin in Refinery 29.
Systems don't dismantle themselves. People do. If you do not address the attitude and behaviors of the decision makers, the people who have the power and need to do better, it means that all the listening and all the learning won't go anywhere.
That is what she said.
So there you have it, guys. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you heard today, it would mean the world to us if you would subscribe and leave a comment or a rating.
And we'd love it if you would share this with your friends by screenshotting the episode and sharing it on social by tagging at Teach Me How to Adult Podcast and DM us with any topics or guests you'd like to hear on the show. See you next time. Bye.